The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. West St. Louis County has been a Republican stronghold for generations, but Democrats have been making inroads, especially since Donald Trump emerged on the presidential scene. One of the people who has benefited from this Democratic shift is State Representative Jacqueline Zimmerman. And the Manchester Democrat joins us on the next episode of Politically Speaking to talk about her party's chances in the 2026 elections and her first impressions of life in Jefferson City. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in Oralto over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us in studio today, she represents Missouri's 98th House District.
Jacqueline Zimmerman.
And a first-time guest, so welcome to the show. And for people that are not aware of the beautiful and scenic 98th House District, just tell me what municipalities are in it.
It covers Manchester, Twin Oaks, and Valley Park.
And I want to talk a little bit about you. I understand that you are a Steeleville native. Is that true?
Yes. I grew up in Steeleville, Missouri. My parents grew up there. My grandparents grew up there. So I lived there my whole life until I left for college.
Okay, I have a big question. Have you ever been to Dillard Mill State Park?
Yes, I have been to Dillard Mill State Park.
I went during the pandemic, and I know this is going to sound really strange, but sometimes I close my eyes and I imagine like a wide open field where I am the only person in it. That's what it felt like to be at Dillard Mill. Like, it is like the most beautiful scenery within your imagination, basically. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if you felt that way. You probably just saw like a pond and an old mill, but I think it is one of the best state parks in the state.
It is very beautiful. It is a beautiful area. I actually have an aunt that lives nearby there. So it is beautiful. So I do get the sense of awe that you felt when you were there. There's a lot of beautiful country down in that near Steeleville and around that area.
So how did you go from being in Steeleville, which is a decidedly rural part of the state, to one of the more suburban parts of the state?
I sort of journeyed around the state. I went to college at Missouri State, which back when I was there was still Southwest Missouri State.
Yes, so they were still really good at women's basketball.
They
back
were.
Then.
I was there during the Jackie Stiles era. So I went to college down there, and then I decided to go to law school. So I went to Kansas City, and after I got out of law school, my now husband was working in St. Louis, and I found a job clerking for a federal judge, Judge David Nose, after law school. So I moved to St. Louis, and my husband is from St. Louis County, so that's where we set up our roots.
So the 98th House District used to be commonly represented by a Republican until 2019, when Trish Gunby captured the district. Since then, it's been in Democratic hands, but it is still pretty competitive. Tell us what prompted you to run for this seat, which I'm sure you knew getting in. This was not going to be a seat where you could just walk in and expect to win.
Yeah, no, I knew it was pretty competitive. It was sort of like a perfect timing issue when I was, I'll admit, I was approached to run. Getting into politics wasn't really on my to-do list. Always been very vocal about politics, very opinionated, very involved. But the person who served my district, Deb Lavender, she was termed out and they were looking for someone to run in that area. And I really feel like it just was, like I said, catching lightning in a bottle. I have the kind of job, I'm an attorney, but I am self-employed. I work for myself. So I was able to kind of have some flexibility there because you have to spend a lot of time in Jefferson City. And I really wanted, I felt like the time was right to step up. I wasn't very necessarily happy with the way Missouri politics were going. I felt with my legal background, I would be an asset in Jefferson City. We don't have a lot of lawyers in the General Assembly. We could always use more. So I sort of just took the leap, felt like the time was right to step up and do my part, essentially.
We got to remember, 2024 was not a great year for Democrats, even in Missouri. Even though, as we'll discuss, Western St. Louis County has become more hospitable for Democrats, but it was not great for a lot of Democratic candidates there. So what were some of the issues that maybe signaled to you that, like, yeah, I have a chance of pulling this off?
One of the things that I was surprised that I heard about a lot, and even from a lot of men, which I know that sounds, they were concerned about the abortion issue and Amendment 3 more than I heard that a lot more than I thought from people on both sides of the aisle. So that was an issue that I think was important to a lot of people. People were also very concerned about schools and school funding. Our public schools in the 98th district are some of the best in the state. We have Valley Park, we've got Parkway, Rockwood, all are in my district. And people want to support those schools. And I think they felt like me and maybe my party were the best opportunity to see those schools supported in the way they needed to be.
So I am shamefully from suburban Chicago. So I'm not, depending on who you ask, I'm not a native Missourian, whatever, because I moved here by choice. But my dad was born in St. Louis and raised in Chesterfield. So I am very well aware of the political dynamics of Western St. Louis County. Used to be a super Republican stronghold, and some parts are still very Republican. But as I kind of mentioned, it has become much more hospitable for Democrats, especially since Donald Trump came on the scene. Do you think Trump is the reason why, like, people like you can compete and win in Western St. Louis County? Or do you think it's actually kind of a backlash against, like, the state legislature and what they do, or maybe a combination of both?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think the Trump era that we're in right now has sort of opened some people's eyes to what's going on that may otherwise not have been paying attention, because it's just so in your face, the stuff that's going on. People that may have been more indifferent to politics and weren't paying attention have sort of been more aware of some of the things that are going on. And then I think the continuation of that is paying attention to what's actually happening in Jefferson City. You know, a lot of people don't pay attention to their state politicians, don't know who their representatives or senators are. And I think they're starting to pay a little bit more attention because they're seeing, you know, that the voters will was sort of completely ignored the last session. And I think a lot of that has sort of opened some people's eyes of what's really going on.
Well, let's talk about your first legislative session. You are about to finish your first year as a member of the Missouri House. Congratulations. I hope your sanity is still intact.
A little bit.
What was the experience like for you as somebody who probably paid attention to Missouri politics, but until like last year was not expected to be a participant in it?
I will say there was a lot of it that was shocking, sort of the process of how everything gets done. They always say, you know, when you see how laws get made, it's, I don't remember what the old adage is, something
you never
about
want
making
to see
sausage.
What,
you never want to see how it gets made.
And,
yes.
And sausage is good, but like you definitely don't want to see it get yes. made, but continue.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that was how it was there. How much control the Speaker of the House has over everything that gets done. I mean, nothing gets done without his okay. So how much power is sort of seated in one person was a little bit surprising to me. Sort of the chaotic nature of the building, too, was a little surprising. And I say this as someone who comes from a legal background. Courts and lawyers are very serious all of the time. There's always this sense of seriousness and professionalism. And the Capitol was a little more chaotic and frenzied, which I wasn't quite as used to, not being quite as formal as my legal background had been. But it was interesting to see how things get done, to see how the lobbying all works from that side and what things people are pushing through and what's important to people. It was definitely an experience. Eye-opening in a lot of ways, but I really enjoyed it. I met a lot of great people. I learned a lot. It's probably one of my, as an adult, one of the most informative and exciting years that I've had. So
it seems to me that there was at least some attempt of the two parties to work together, like until the last week of session, where there were a couple of things that happened. First, there was the torpedoing of this capital improvements bill. I don't remember the number of it at this point, like House Bill 16 or something. I don't know. I'll look it up. But that was one thing. And then on the last couple days of session, the Senate ended up forcing votes to try and overturn voter-approved abortion rights initiatives, as well as just repealing paid sick leave requirements. Mm-hmm. So was it contentious before this time period, or was this a situation where things were going pretty well until like the last week? And since then, it's just gone completely off the rails, basically.
I really do feel like there was a lot of bipartisan cooperation during the session. And I guess that's one of the other things that did surprise me. So kind of going back to the other question, sorry.
Well, that's okay.
Was that you always see on the news how much everyone is fighting. You only hear about those things. So many bills, the vast majority of them pass with bipartisan support. So there really is a lot of cooperation, at least in the House where I'm sitting and seeing every day, where we passed bills, you know, that everyone agreed on were good for the state. So that's the most, you know, the vast majority of stuff is bipartisan. But yes, I do feel like everything just sort of exploded in that last week. The Senate did some, you know, PQ'd people that just doesn't happen over there, and some of that stuff with the budget just came out of complete left field. So yeah, and like you said, after that, it's just been, I'm curious to see how we'll go into 2026 with the sort of hard feelings that were left at the end of 2025.
And we'll talk more about that later. Mm-hmm. But let's talk more specifically about the two things that were at least attempted to be repealed or repealed. The paid sick leave situation was surprising to me. I'm going to be very candid. First of all, that passed with 58% of the vote. It wasn't close. They were not hiding the fact that there was paid sick leave on it. It was one of the reasons, like, why they felt it would pass so much. But I think, like, the surprising thing for me on this was the proponents of this could just circulate a constitutional amendment. And then if that passes, which I assume it would because it passed 2 years ago or a year ago, it's the legislature won't be able to overturn it. Do you think that was a strategic misstep by Republicans to do this, given that possibility?
Yeah, probably so, because I think this has upset a lot of people. I was surprised as well how adamant they were to overturn that. It's obviously popular with workers in Missouri to have paid sick leave. Everybody who seemed to support repealing it, I always heard, you know, that it was hurting business owners, or they'd heard from business owners. I was just concerned that nobody was talking about hearing from the actual employees and workers who would benefit from paid sick leave. So, yeah, that comes with a, you know, they should be concerned that it will be put back out there as a constitutional amendment.
On the abortion measure, and when I say abortion measure, what they put on the ballot next year is a plan to basically repeal almost all of Amendment 3 from 2024. There are limited exceptions for up to 12 weeks of if you're a victim of rape or incest, life of the mother, fatal fetal abnormalities. I wasn't as surprised that they were going to do this, and I'll tell you why. I just want to put myself in the shoes of a lay Republican legislator. If you're running for office in a super Republican district, one of the things you're going to be asked is, do you support abortion rights? And I would say 99% of them are going to say, no, I think it's immoral, I think it's wrong, and I'm going to try to fight for, you know, I'm just using their phrase, the unborn or whatever. So I'm not really surprised there was a counterattack to Amendment 3 from 2024 with Amendment 3 from 2026. Was that your impression, too?
I agree. I wasn't surprised at that either. I don't feel like, unfortunately, I don't feel like this is an issue where this fight is ever going to stop anytime soon. We're not going to stop fighting for abortion rights, and I don't think that Republicans are going to give up either, obviously, based on what happened this year. It's unfortunate because I feel like no one ever knows exactly what their rights are. We're kind of living in a chaotic period where it's a right. Now it's not a right. Now it's a right. And that's going to be, it's not good for citizens to constantly be living in this sort of chaotic upheaval with what their rights are. And unfortunately, that's where we're at right now.
Let me rip the Band-Aid off and let's talk about the redistricting special session. When you heard that you were going back into session for the second special session to do redistricting, what was your general thought about how this was going to go and the fact that you had to do this in the middle of the decade?
I was shocked when they actually called a special session. I mean, there had been rumblings about it for weeks before it actually happened. And maybe it's just, I really thought when it came down to it, Governor Kehoe would understand how unpopular that was going to be, and even if it wasn't unpopular, how much of just a power grab it appeared. The visuals of it were just, the optics of it were not good from any side, I wouldn't think. But we did it, and it seemed like we just rammed that through. I mean, he called a special session. We were back in a week, just ramming through a map that nobody could really explain to us where it came from, who drew it. We found out later they'd been actually in direct communication with the president's office. So it was just I felt like it was completely something they were doing on behalf of the president's office to earn favor and was not in any way paying attention to what the people of Missouri actually wanted, which I just think is kind of sad.
Speaking of paying attention, do you think many of your colleagues knew the map could be placed up for a referendum? I know you can't peer into their minds, but I got a sense from talking with a couple of them that like they did not know that that was a possibility coming in.
I honestly don't know. I never discussed any of that with any of my colleagues. I do know even some of them on the other side of the aisle, even though they voted for it, didn't necessarily agree with it. But I don't know if they knew that the referendum was a possibility. I never discussed that with anyone.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you. Like, I didn't realize it was a possibility until we were going into the second week of the special session. And I looked at the amount of Republicans there were in the House and I was like, wait a second, there's not enough votes for an emergency clause on this. And I think that the thing that's really important to point out here is if they get enough signatures and this federal lawsuit that Attorney General Hanaway is trying to do to prevent the referendum from happening fails, this map can basically not go into effect in 2026. And that's where I was like, whoever planned this out in D.C. really didn't think this through very hard. Because, like, this is not going to benefit the Republicans at all in 2026. So that's more of a statement than a question. But feel free to riff off it if you want to.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's too many questions. Like you said, too many lawsuits. There's too much going on that this is going to be something that's going to be in effect in less than a year by the time we have next November's elections. Obviously, this was rushed. I mean, this couldn't have gone quicker, I don't think, than them giving us a map, rushing everybody to Jeff City for a special session and putting this all together. I think by the time this gets tied up in lawsuits and referendum, I don't think it will be a possibility in 2026, but
we don't know for sure. And even if the referendum stuff falters, there's still a chance like the Missouri Supreme Court could say you can't do mid-decade redistricting and that's it. And then the map dissolves into the ether. One thing, though, I do want to ask about next session. So it is hypothetically possible for the legislature to move the referendum date from November to, say, April or something. You would still be past the filing deadline, so you'd probably have to attach something to move the filing deadline to. Frankly, though, I think that would be a terrible move politically. If you only had one thing on an April ballot, I think it guarantees the map will be voted down. And I think if it's on in November, I think it's kind of a 50-50 proposition. Has anybody told you that's a possibility at all? Or do you think that they're just going to see how their signature stuff goes, and if it gets enough, they're just going to have it in November at this point?
I heard some rumors back a while back that it might go on in April, but like you said, I think that'll bring out people that are passionate about it, you know, about the BAPS not passing if there's just that one thing on the April ballot. And I think it just looks even more – well, I've always thought, like I said, the optics of it look really bad. To me, it just looks like a power grab. I think that looks even worse. You're just trying to rush it through even more to get it just sort of pushed through so they can obtain another seat in November.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative Jacqueline Zimmerman.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Representative Jacqueline Zimmerman. She is a Democrat from Manchester, and she represents the 98th House District. There was another thing at that special session that I'd like to talk about, and that is a measure that would basically make it nearly impossible for an initiative petition that tries to amend the Constitution to pass. You would need 8 out of 8 congressional districts and a majority vote. I think, like, I've seen a lot of proposals to try and make it harder to amend the Constitution. So everything from, like, raising the threshold to 57%, raising the threshold to 60%, 5 out of 8 congressional districts. You can quibble with the idea of that or the substance of that, but there are other states that have a higher threshold than just 50% plus one. So I kind of understand that. This seems like, and I don't mean this pejoratively, the most like draconian dismantling of the IP process that I have seen. And I was really surprised it passed. Were you also surprised it passed, given just how high the bar would be to pass something under this measure?
I wasn't surprised that it passed. I figured if we were hearing it, it was going to pass. That was sort of my opinion. They had the votes. They, you know, there were some Republicans that were not supportive of it, but I wasn't surprised that it passed.
How do you think that voters are going to receive this proposal? Because it has some things that are attached to it that I guess could be seen as really like appealing to voters, like banning foreign contributions to ballot initiatives. But there's also things that I think are really exploitable, like the fact that the legislature can put a constitutional amendment on the ballot and it would still only need 50% plus one, whereas a initiative petition constitutional amendment would need 8 out of 8 congressional districts. Like, how do you think this is going to be received by voters?
I don't think voters are going to like this very much. I think it's just another attempt to sort of silence the vote of the people, or dilute it, if nothing else. It sort of just continues on from what happened last session when the legislator just overturned Amendment 3, or not overturned it, but went against the will of the people by trying to go against what they had voted for just in November of 2024. And now they're trying to make this whole process even more difficult. I don't think voters are going to appreciate that very much. It's just trying to silence them and make their vote not count as much.
So let's talk about the 2026 session. I thought expectations for 2024 were low. And I think that was like the lowest expectations I've ever had. I think the expectations for 2026 are even lower just because of all the tumult that has happened over the past 6 months. Am I being too cynical here, or is like the only thing we should expect to pass maybe is a budget and not much else?
That might very well be the case. I don't want to say that. Like I said, there's a lot of bipartisan stuff that comes through. So I really think there will be some good stuff that will be accomplished this year. Like I said, some of that stuff isn't the the sexy stuff that makes the news, but I think there will be some good stuff that will come out of this session. There might also be some things that I think aren't so great, but I'm hopeful that we can get some good stuff done.
If you had the supernatural ability to get a particular issue or a set of issues into kind of the forefront of discussion, what would be some things you would want to work on next year?
One of the things that is most important to me is our public education system. I really feel so strongly that we should be trying to make it the best we can. Fund it, really try to make it an example for public schools in America. Instead, I sort of see us going in the opposite direction. So I hope, if nothing else, we can reverse that track a little bit and try to prop them up and help out our public schools and make them the best that they can be. It's always been a big, important issue for me.
I'm interested to, I don't know how much you've talked with your constituents about this, but this was like a big sea change in terms of funding this year when I guess the state is providing $50 million for scholarships that could go to private schools. Like, that is a big Rubicon crossing for Missouri education. What has been sort of the reaction amongst your constituents, given that there are really strong public schools in your district, but I also think that there are probably people in your district that send the kids to private schools for various reasons. I'm interested to hear what your constituent reaction to that has been.
The constituents that have reached out to me about this and that I have otherwise talked to are not happy with $50 million going to private schools. So if I have people in my district that do send their kids to private schools, they haven't reached out to me applauding the allotment of that money towards private school vouchers. I think people in my district are pretty proud of their public schools and they want to maintain them at a good level. I know that there's a lot of concern right now. Parkway especially gets most of its money from local taxes, and there's sort of an issue now with the senior property tax freeze that's going on that's going to cost Parkway a lot of money. And so I know there's just some concerns overall that, you know, the schools are going to really be hit by some of these cuts.
So I don't believe you're on the budget committee.
I am not.
Which is probably both a shame and a blessing for you because it's an all-consuming process.
Yes.
But my expectation is the budget next year is not going to be easy, where there's no longer like federal money that is basically propping up the budget like it has in previous years. And let's just be honest here. The economy is not like in full-scale recession yet, but it is not as strong as it was maybe a year or two ago. So when I joked about like the budget being the only thing that passed, I'm not even really sure that the budget will get done on time because there's going to have to maybe be a lot of hard decisions that are going to be made. And also, like, this also gets into kind of some inside baseball stuff. Like, the Democrats maybe needed to pass the budget because there may be a lot of Republicans, especially in the Senate, that don't want to vote for it for various reasons. So your party is going to be a lot more impactful in this process. The party, by the way, which we have spent like the last 30 minutes talking about being thrown under the bus constantly in the last 6 months. So that, again, I've been rambling a little bit during this conversation. So let me just succinctly ask you the question. How hard is the budget situation going to be? And how impactful do you think Democrats are going to be for the process, given that there's often division among Republicans about how to craft a budget?
I think that the budget process this year is going to be difficult, especially given that not only did we cut the capital gains tax last year, which is going to be a huge blow to the budget, the governor now wants to phase out income tax, which makes up, I think, half of our budget. So it's huge. I don't know how, and I haven't seen any ideas how we plan on making up for those shortfalls. So it's hard to maintain a budget when you're cutting, you know, sources of revenue. A lot of programs, a lot of stuff is going to have to be cut, and there's going to be some very difficult decisions that are going to have to be made. I do think that Democrats are going to have more of a
impact.
Impact, yeah.
Yes.
I was trying to think of the word. An impact on these discussions Because you're right, Republicans don't agree necessarily where funds need to go. So that's where we kind of come in and you know, can help out with those numbers on getting the votes on stuff that's important to us.
So let's shift to the more politically side of politically speaking and talk about elections. So I mentioned that Western St. Louis County has become more Democratic in recent years. But Republicans are still winning House and Senate seats there, not by the margins they did when, like, my grandpa was still alive. But, like, why do you think there is this dynamic where Western St. Louis County is voting for progressive ballot initiatives like abortion rights, paid sick leave, but besides you, obviously, since you won, Republicans are still getting elected to House and Senate seats? I'd be interested in your theory on that, given that we cannot poll every single voter in Western St. Louis County, and they may have different reasons, but I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
I think, unfortunately, a lot of times people don't pay as much attention to state politics as they should. I always tell people the state politics are probably affect more of your day-to-day life than the federal stuff does. They just don't see about as much of it on the news to necessarily know what their representative is voting for. They do, and this sort of happens all over Missouri, though. People will vote for progressive, you know, policies on the ballot and then vote for Republicans. And I just think we need to do a better job getting the message out there, how these votes are going. And I think that that would help maybe turn some of this, turn the tide a little bit on that.
So we just to sum up for our listeners, what is going to be on the ballot specifically, like in not only in Western St. Louis County, but the entire state? We're going to have a measure to try to repeal the abortion rights amendment, which, by the way, it wouldn't have passed without Republicans. If you look at the amount of people who voted for Amendment 3 and the amount of people who voted for Kamala Harris, I think there are about 200,000 Trump voters who voted for it. So that's number one. Number two is the IP-related things and the referendum. And there also could be a measure to try to make it much more difficult for the legislature to overturn ballot initiatives, which is known as the Respect Mo Voters Initiative. And we'll talk about this in a second. There also could be a really competitive congressional race in the 2nd District, too. What do you think this is going to do to turnout in 2026? It seems like all those things could, like, hypercharge Democratic turnout if there is enough organizational support to bring the voters there. What's your thought about that?
I think those issues will bring a high turnout to next November's election, especially given, I guess, just the state of politics nationally. I think people are paying a little bit more attention. If we do have issues like abortion and the initiative petition and you know, the gerrymandering issues on the ballot, I really do think that will draw people out, will make the Democratic turnout higher. I'm hopeful that we can get the message out there to voters that this stuff is out there and that they need to pay attention and read the language closely, and hopefully we'll have some good results.
So I mentioned the 2nd Congressional District. You were recently at a rally for Fred Wellman, who is one of the Democratic candidates running to unseat Congresswoman Ann Wagner. I guess one question is why Fred Wellman, but number two, like, how are you feeling about that race going into 2026? Because I'll mention this in the next question. A lot of Democrats in the 2nd District often feel very confident that it can beat Ann Wagner, and she's still there. So what is your feeling about this time around?
I am confident that we can put in a better showing than we have in the past. I don't know how she keeps coming out on top of this situation. She doesn't really do much for anybody that I've been able to see. So I like Fred. I like that he's a veteran. He's sort of just a salt of the earth kind of guy. I like, you know, he's got a lot of experience helping people getting out there and doing the work. And I'm hopeful that he can get, you know, around and really get the message out there. And he's good at talking to people. So I think he's got a good way of just communicating with people and relating to people that I think will really resonate with voters.
Does it matter to you which version of the 2nd District the Democrat runs in? I would say that the new version, which includes, like, very small counties like Washington, Gasconade in your home base of Crawford. And the old one doesn't have those, but it still has Franklin and St. Charles and Warren counties. Does it matter which district that ends up being run in? I see the differences as not insignificant, but not super significant.
You're probably right. When you look at those numbers and what rural counties we gained and lost in this map, I guess, in CD2, it's probably a negligible difference. I feel like, and this, you know, this is just me being, I feel like it's more, it feels geographically different in a way where I'm like, people in Gasconade County, how can they be represented by, you know, the same person as me up in St. Louis County, West St. Louis County? It just seems, I mean, obviously that's crazy and that's how the maps are all over. It's just from a geographical and needs of the community, it just seems a little crazy. But I think probably from a voter standpoint or how it's going to turn out, you're probably right. It's probably a negligible difference, but
we'll have to see. Mm-hmm. What do you think would be a successful election cycle for Democrats in Missouri? Obviously, if Ann Wagner gets ousted, I think that is successful. Like, no question about it. But is it also defeating some of these ballot initiatives and also gaining some House seats in, let's say, St. Louis County, you know, suburban Kansas City, maybe even Springfield and elsewhere? Is that basically success for Democrats, given that there's only one statewide election, it's state auditor, and I think even if there is a strong Democratic challenger, I think Scott Fitzpatrick is probably favored in that race. So what's sort of your thought process about what a successful 2026 would be?
Yeah, I think a successful 2026 would be definitely picking up some House seats, which I think is very doable. I'm sort of on the edge of, I always say I'm the last blue seat before it just turns red, but you go beyond my district and the wins there are negligible for, you know, Republicans. So I think we can creep out into West County a little bit more and pick up some seats. I think, you know, getting out there and doing the work and having the good candidates out there will make that possible for us. I think, yeah, and I think there's some seats to be picked up in Kansas City and possibly Springfield as well. That will help us out a lot. We will have a lot more say in Jefferson City. You know, our votes will matter. They can't just ignore our our thoughts and opinions on things that pass in the House. So I think that is the best case scenario. And I think it's doable. I am hopeful that that is going to be the outcome.
Well, Representative, thank you so much for joining us. I believe this, you told me beforehand this was your first podcast ever, and I thought you did a fantastic job. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
For all of our stories, you can go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of the University of Missouri St. Louis. And Representative, if people want to find you online or on social media, how can people find out more about you or get in touch with you?
My campaign website is jacquelynezimmerman.com, which is always spelled very oddly, Jacquelynezimmerman. I'm also on Facebook under Jacqueline Zimmerman and Instagram as well. And you can always reach out to my office in Jefferson City. The contact information is on the webpage there.
Very good. So. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lippman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.